Dr. Orth, good to have you with us. This is the annual VIMS report on the status of submerged aquatic vegetation.
Is it possible to turn the lights off?
I'm not asleep.
Yeah, don't go to sleep. Okay, thank you very much. This is my annual presentation, which I normally make around September, October, but for a variety of reasons, which one of which was Sandy, I'm here before you today. And again, this presentation is something that I do each year for you all to give you an update on what's going on with SAV Baywide, and these are some of the issues that we'll talk about today. I'll try to be cognizant of the fact that there are quite a few public hearings, but with two new members on the board, I may need to give a little background regarding each of these particular issues. And, okay. So for the two of you that are new, you know, why am I up here talking about SAV or underwater grasses? These plants are the sentinels of water quality. They're being used as one of the indicators for improving water quality in the bay, and you've probably all heard over and over the importance of water quality in Chesapeake Bay and the efforts to improve it, and you probably have heard the four letters TMDL, total maximum daily load. This is probably one of the more important topics that all the local communities are going to be faced with, because there is an effort to improve water quality. And how do we determine if we're making improvements? This is one of the resources that responds very rapidly to water quality changes, because it is very sensitive to light. And light changes, these plants can increase or decrease. And so consequently, everyone is interested in what's happening with bay grasses. So that's one of the reasons why I'm here for this prospect. Okay, one of the more important components of this was that over the last few years, of course, we've worked very closely with management agencies, and the states of Virginia and Maryland incorporated the acreage of SAV into their water quality standards. So in addition to things like phosphorus and nitrogen, they now include the abundance of SAV in their water quality standards, so that when you're looking at these areas that have SAV, literally every acre counts. So let's start off with the baywide SAV status. What does VIMS do? We've been monitoring these bay grasses every year since about 1984 using aerial photography, and those little red lines represent flight lines across every single shallow water area of the bay, and we map these beds using sophisticated GIS mapping tools to identify every single grass bed in the bay, and we follow those grass beds over time and report that information to all of the management agencies in the bay region around the end of February. They're very interested in what's going on. And of course, we get a lot of questions from individuals in different areas. What's happening in my part of the river, my part of the bay for SAV? So this is something that we do, and VIMS has a responsibility of doing this on a bay-wide effort. So we cover the entire area from the Susquehanna Flats at the head of the bay all the way to the mouth, and including the coastal bays, both in Virginia and Maryland. So very quickly, here are the numbers of SAV in the bay. And we have it in hectares, which there are a little over 2 acres per hectare. And the interesting thing is that the Chesapeake Bay has adopted a restoration target of about 185,000 acres, 75,000 hectares. We're well below that target, but again, this is a goal. They want to get grass beds back to many of the locations where they were historically. So, for example, in the Potomac River, in the lower Potomac, in the Rappahannock River, where grass beds used to be everywhere and where people used to be able to fish and crab, these areas no longer have it. The idea is to get these grass beds back there. So that's what they mean by a restoration target. And right now for 2011, and these are the numbers for 2011, I don't have 2012 because we are working on those right now. This was a crazy year because, if you recall, 2011 we had Irene and Lee, which had a huge impact in the upper bay with a huge turbidity plume, which had a big impact on many of the grasses, and we were not able to acquire a lot of photography. So that's why it's a little symbol up there with a partial data set. So if you look at the Chesapeake Bay by region, and remembering that there are different plant species in different parts of the bay. So in the lower bay, we have a couple species that like salt. As you move up into the freshwater areas, there are lots of plants that you might even see in your home aquaria that actually grow in the Chesapeake Bay, and we monitor those trends. So what we based it is our low salinity and a medium salinity, that is this green area here, and the low salinity is this kind of grayish area. And then the red area is the high salinity area. And what you see for the high salinity areas, not very encouraging, in that over time, we have been watching actually a decline of the amount of grasses in the lower bay, not an improvement, suggesting that there is still a big issue with water quality. But we're also having, as you know, a lot of warm years, and the plants that grow in the lower bay don't like it hot. So as it gets hotter, we're seeing some big issues with persistence of plants in some of these river systems. The mid-bay area is really kind of interesting because that includes some of the places like Bloodsworth and South Marsh. We've had some changes there, and the resurgence of the grasses is by a species that comes and goes very rapidly. And so that's why you see these huge changes in the mid-bay area of one species that comes some year, that's abundant some years, other years it just disappears. The more interesting thing, too, is that in the freshwater areas, we're seeing a huge resurgence of plants in the freshwater areas that does appear to be related to reduction in nitrogen loading. We're seeing that in the head of the bay here, the flats, and I'm going to show you a little area here in the James River that we've been very encouraged by its resurgence. This is the Mobjack Bay area and the Pocosin Flats, and this is, again, one of the areas that we have concern, and we keep on sending this message to the managers. This is not a very this is a trend that's very challenging and very serious, and we are concerned about it. And as you can see, the goal was much higher than what we were seeing in terms of the present abundance. This is the James River. These are the numbers. And again, I could go through lots of data, lots of pictures and all that, but again, this is just an overview, and if any of you are interested, you can always call me later. But this is what's happening in the James River. Now, the James is kind of, and this is the upper James. This is not the lower James. This is all the freshwater areas. And we are, again, seeing a big resurgence, some of it in the Chickahominy, some of it in the main stem that we had never seen before. So there are some positive things happening in some of these rivers. Some of this is being driven by an exotic called hydrilla, but it's still an underwater plant, and in some places provides a lot of good benefits to the river. So we are encouraged in parts of the James and parts of the upper river areas where we are seeing a resurgence. Let me quickly move on to the Chesapeake Bay SAB Sanctuary. And again, if you have any questions, stop me, but I'm trying to recognize that you've got a lot of public hearing people here today and would love to probably get home in time for dinner. Chesapeake Bay SAB Sanctuary, Chincoteague SAB Sanctuary. Back in the late 90s, we recognized some crazy things going on in Chincoteague. These circles were done by people who were harvesting clams using a modified oyster dredge and destroying the grass beds. We worked very closely with staff and the watermen in these areas to come up with a sanctuary, which they'd agreed upon. And we established bounds using markers and enforcement. It kind of worked because here are the data from that time period where we saw all those scars and the time period in which we actually didn't mark it, and then we marked it, and once we marked the sanctuary, we have seen very little scarring in these grass beds in Chincoteague Bay. So this has worked, and again, through, I think, proper enforcement, we've been able to at least keep the grass beds healthy in Chincoteague. Propeller scarring, another issue that we brought to the board many years ago. These were propeller scars from individuals who are haul seining, bringing their nets into the area. We worked, again, very closely with staff and the watermen to come up with appropriate guidelines that would not limit haul seining but would recognize that they are damaging the beds. And, again, with staff, we worked very closely to come up with types of things that would allow the continuation of haul seining but also let them know that these beds were important and we didn't want to do the scarring. So we watched the scarring really carefully. Two areas that we've watched very carefully, the Browns Bay area and Guinea Marsh area, one off Pocosin Flats. We've also watched carefully Allen's Island and Goodwin Island and the Lower York River. What we do here, this is a picture of Browns Bay in 1997. These are the grass beds here. These are all these scars that are from the propellers of the boats. It's not the nets. These are the propellers, and we've told everyone it's not the nets that are doing the damage. It was the propellers of the boats. And with some just minor modification of adjusting the hull into times when the propeller did not damage the grass beds, it's worked. Because let me show you the data. Browns Bay, now what these lines represent is we measured all those lines, and we followed each one of those lines in successive years. So in 1993, there were over almost 100,000 meters of scarring. Well, what we found when we did the work is that they recover very quickly, and in a few years, you don't see much. But I think by just the recognition of what's happening and modifying the hauling and letting people know that this was something that was a concern to a lot of people, with that, you can see that in Browns Bay, the number of scars have really dropped off considerably and has maintained at very low levels. I've enhanced that a little bit because we still see some scarring, But we haven't been concerned and haven't brought that to the board because these scars do recover very quickly, so it's not necessary to really do much. And just keep the watermen informed of what we're seeing so that they know that, you know, we don't want to do anything that's going to have any impact on the type of work they're doing and their livelihood. So that was Browns Bay. Here's Pecosa Flats again. Scars that occur in 95 recover really quickly. These are the exact same types of grafts. And again, you can see after we brought this issue to the commission and worked with the watermen and tried to recognize again the need that this is their livelihood and not constrain them to that. Again, we haven't seen much, and this is an enhanced version. Again, some scarring, but nothing compared to what you saw in the past. We brought this issue to the board in 2009. This is an aerial photograph enhanced where we were doing some eelgrass restoration in the lower York River. These were plots of eelgrass that we were planting. We saw these lines through it. Again, we met with the watermen and your staff, and what we did was we agreed that we would put a series of poles where they agreed to haul their nets on this side of the poles where we would be doing our restoration on that side of the poles. And you can see they come in across here, and they come in across here, and it's worked. There have been some issues where when this happens and we see this, I personally go to Mr. Jenkins' house and we talk about it and try to resolve the issue in a compromising way that they recognize what we're trying to do and we recognize that they want to do, and it's worked. And so when we have a problem, he contacts his relatives and said, listen, you got to be careful about what's going on. So it's worked, and again, it's not needed to come before you guys and say, here's another problem. We just work it out among ourselves. And it's worked. I think we've done really well, and Mr. Jenkins has been very accommodating when we've talked about these issues. Aquaculture issues, you know, you hear aquaculture all the time. These are clam aquaculture nets. You know, certainly something the state wants. You hear about it all the time, but there are conflicts when they occur in shallow water areas, exactly where eelgrass likes to grow. And again, we've worked very closely with both your staff and the industry. We developed a regulation that basically said, you know, you can't put new structures on areas that have been existing grass. And again, we work very closely with your staff both here on the Eastern Shore, here on the Western Shore and the Eastern Shore. Whenever a permit comes in, you know, we map and they know where the grass beds are and they try to get some idea of what's going on. And I think it's been a good relationship. Sometimes we have to go back and forth about exactly where the boundaries of those lines should be, but it works. Here's one problem that arose, and again, I'll tell you how we dealt with it. We did our aerial photographs in 2011. You see all this grass around here, and you see all these structures. These are clam nets. They were put down at a time when the watermen thought there was no grass. So we brought this to their attention. We met with the people who are doing this activity. We agreed and the commission agreed that we would allow the clam operation to continue until they would harvest the clams, and that we would remove the nets, and that the restoration of this would be accommodated by them helping us collect seeds and restore the area. Now, those nets were going to be removed this fall, but they asked if they could hold off another year. We said, sure, it's not a problem because we know this area has extensive grass, and actually they helped us a lot this year in our seed collection in which we were trying to collect seeds. And so, you know, it's an issue where, again, we're trying to work with them rather than bring things to you. We work among ourselves. And I think it works out pretty well. Our big project that I'm going to spend a little more time on is our seagrass restoration in the seaside bays. And this couples with our recent bay scallop restoration where I introduced you to that topic last year. The whole topic is eelgrass and bay scallop restoration on the seaside. A quick background. All of these areas in the bay, the coastal bays, had eelgrass, which is an area in red in the 30s. There was a big decline in the 30s. A lot of it rebounded, and by the 60s, we still had a lot of eelgrass in the bay. We did not see any eelgrass return to these coastal bays, and even through the 90s, there was nothing. We found some patches in the early 90s and initiated a large-scale restoration effort in these coastal bays. And the goal was, of course, the reestablishment of eelgrass and the bay scallops, which were once incredibly abundant in these coastal bays and provided a huge commercial fishery. We're doing work in these four bays that were the places where eelgrass was very abundant in the 30s and where the bay scallops were commercially harvested. These are the four bays of South Bay, Cobb, Spider Crab, and Hog Island Bay. We monitor a lot about water quality, which I'm not going to get into, but these boxes are where we've done our restoration work. This is a seed-based restoration effort. We use a lot of volunteers to help us collect seeds, and you can see this is the grass bed in the bottom here with people collecting seeds. These are the seeds of eelgrass, which are essentially pretty small, but we collect them in. We simply broadcast these seeds into these areas, which is actually how they spread naturally. So we use a technique that basically nature shows us the way to do it, and it works really well because starting in 1998, we started putting seeds, and these are the numbers of acres of seeds that we planted. So through 2012, we planted about 380 acres, but in the mapping of these grass beds, through 2012, we're now about 4,600 acres of eelgrass, bottom that has eelgrass, which is impressive. I mean, these beds have spread because they're not challenged by water quality, and they're also near the ocean, so they get this cooler water. So, I mean, this is probably one of the most successful restoration efforts anywhere in the world, and people are watching what we're doing, but it's really neat because the next step is where we get into the base scouts, which I'll touch upon briefly at the end of this talk here. It's going to be kind of tough to see. This is the area in 2001. You're looking through the belly of a plane, looking down 2 miles. This is one of the coastal islands here. It's called Wreck Island. The inlets are here and here. So you can't see much in here, but you see these little dark squares. These are our one-acre plots where we put seeds in 2001 and 2002. This is the picture taken in 2006. And while you can't see those plots, it's because this whole area is now about a 1,000-acre seagrass bed. So this is in less than 10 years. It's amazing how quickly these plants spread when not challenged by water quality. These are pictures of the four bays from 2012. This is Cobb. The areas in the outline of the white are the grass beds. You can see really, really thick. This is Hog Island Bay, really, really thick. South Bay, really, really thick. Spider Crab, not quite so. And again, you can see how we do these transplants. We put seeds in plots, and we just follow how these plots spread. Of course, this is how Cobb, Hog, and South Bay were just years ago. We're expecting Spider Crab to do the same thing in a few years. So again, good water quality. These beds spread like weeds. I'm going to skip that. Just a quick thing on water quality. Again, we watch, what these beds do in these areas. You've heard about how seagrass beds baffle waves and improve water quality. Well, we have these instruments that look at a variety of parameters, like how dirty is the water, how green is the water, what's the temperature, what's the salinity, and they monitor these conditions 24/7. And these data are telemetered to the VIMS. And what I'm showing you here is, this is 2003 and 2010. These are what are called box plots. So the bigger this line, the more variation is, the more dirty it is. And the bigger the box here also means that there's a lot more of it. But as you go through time, those boxes get smaller and the bars get shorter, meaning that these grass beds are improving the water clarity. And it's seen in this picture here where you have numbers of hectares versus what we call national turbidity units. But the higher the number, the dirtier the water. And what you're seeing is as the beds were smaller, the water was more turbid, but the more the grass is, the clearer the water. So this is some of the most impressive data that people have seen, because usually people don't see this type of operation. You go out on the sample in this grass bed and not in this grass bed, and they see all these differences. This is the first time we've been able to actually demonstrate, as the bed develops, how these beds improve water clarity. The thing that, again, is interesting, because here's the coastal bays, the numbers, you can see it going up, up, up. Here's the Chesapeake Bay going down, down, down. Chincoteague Bay is doing the same thing. While it was increasing, it's going down, down, down. This polygon is where eelgrass used to be back in the 60s. This is where it is today. It's a real sad story. And again, the whole idea of the Bay Program and improving water quality is that the grass is back into these areas. And what we said over and over, the situation that we see in these coastal bays where we're watching the grass recover really rapidly because they're not challenged by water quality. The water's a little bit cooler. And that makes all the world of difference for these grass beds over there. And we say, if it could be done here and we can really improve water quality, these beds will come back very rapidly if there are seeds. Okay, the last thing, bay scallops. This is really getting to be a fun project, because here are the numbers from back in the late 20s, early 30s. This was the harvest in these two counties, Accomack and Northampton counties. One heck of a lot of bay scallops harvested in these seaside bays. Now, there's always a little bit of a misnomer here when people say bay scallops. Bay scallops only occurred in commercial quantities in the two bays on the seaside, okay? After the decline of eelgrass, which occurred in these coastal bays in 32, there was not a single bay scallop harvested, and they haven't seen bay scallops in commercial quantities since that time. Every once in a while, someone will say, yeah, I got a bay scallop. Well, that happens, but commercial quantities of bay scallops have not been seen since 1932. And just as a little take-home fact, in 2008, in the entire United States, there was 131,000 pounds of bay scallops landed domestically. You just look at what they harvested in 1930, in these two counties alone, 1.8 million pounds of bay scallops. It was an impressive fishery, and there are bay scallop shells all over the seaside. It was one impressive resource. Well, we started because we said, okay, the eelgrass is coming back because you need eelgrass as a setting substrate for the little babies. They're like mussels that you have little bristle threads so that when they swim around in the water, boom, they need a piece of grass to attach to. And as they get bigger, they settle to the bottom. So working with Mark Lukenbach, we have initiated a bay scallop restoration effort where Mark will spawn the clams in his hatchery. We'll put clams out and we'll put them in these cages so that you keep all the scallops close to each other. So when they spawn, you effectively help the fertilization process. You know, if we put scallops free, they would swim away, they would get eaten. It's not like oysters that settle and stay. These bay scallops move. So the whole idea is to put these scallops in these cages and allow them to spawn and facilitate the fertilization. So is it working? Well, we've been doing that for 3 years, and in this past summer, we began to a very quantitative sampling. Okay, is it working? So we used two methods to sample these scallops. We used what's called a suction sampler. It's a vacuum cleaner. And we used it to collect the small ones because the small ones are up on the grass blades. These are less than an inch. And then the bigger ones, the way we find out how the big ones are, we actually have to do this at what's called a visual survey. We put down these kind of plots, and then we actually visually feel for every single scallop by hand. You can't really see them because the water, as you're moving through, gets a little bit turbid. Plus, they sit on the bottom like this, and sometimes they're even hard to see. So we do this visual survey. We did this throughout South Bay, and let me walk you through this. This is the photo from 2012. This is a big grass bed. This is essentially a 1,000-acre grass bed. This is that wreck island, and again, you're again looking at this area through the belly of a plane, and this is all grass. The little yellow numbers, whether it's a 0, a 2, or a 6, that means that at that site we found no scallops per square meter, up to 6 baby scallops per square meter. And the white numbers are the scallops greater than 20 millimeters. So in this place we found we didn't find a lot of big ones, but they were there. And the numbers equate to about not quite 2 million baby scallops and 47,000 big scallops. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but this is the fourth year, and we figured that it may take 10 years to get these bay scallops back. The problem with bay scallops, they only live 2 years. And we have told agencies that are helping us with the funding, we're going to need 10 years to really make this thing work. And the fact that actually people are now finding more bay scallops up and down these coastal bays, we think we're onto something, and we're hoping that with the continued funding that we will continue to demonstrate success. And then if it is, the big challenge is going to be, okay, so what? We want to have a sustainable population, and can we work with the management agencies to develop a sustainable fishery that would allow, again, another resource that watermen can use and harvest? Now, there's a lot of aquaculture going on in these seaside bays, but again, bay scallops is an interesting animal that if you look it up and down the coast, there's a lot of fishery people for that. I mean, like even recreational. So, we think that this has the potential to really provide another source of income. It'll be seasonal, which is what it was earlier. So, again, we're hoping that this could be a great opportunity again to work with the fishery people and come up with a compromise of, how do we keep a sustainable fishery and keep it going. And an interesting problem that we've had. There are a lot of oysters out there in the seaside, and one of the problems that we've had in keeping these scallops in cages is that they're a great settling substrate for oysters. So if you look at a bay scallop shell right here, it is covered with oysters. And the problem we've had is that because they're kept in cages, they get oysters settling on them. And you don't normally see like bay scallops with an oyster on top of it. So one of the things that we have to do is come up with a method that allows these bay scallops to spawn. And as soon as they spawn the first and second time, we let them go. rather than keeping them in cages, because if they get covered over like this, then they're no good, whereas if they're out swimming around, they still may be able to spawn in their second year. So this has been a challenge, and we're working very closely with Mark Lukeback on the Eastern Shore. This is actually his baby, but we're working very closely with him, and we think, again, we're pretty excited. I mean, again, like our eelgrass project, very few people believe that we could do it. We did it. They're saying the same thing about the bay scallops, and I guess I'm a little optimistic that maybe in 5 years we might have a commercial fishery seasonal over on the seaside of the coastal bays. So in summary, really quickly wrapping up, some of the main points, again, I want to leave you with is, again, for most of the grass beds in the bay, water quality is the issue. We are having a concern about eelgrass, and we're concerned about the water quality and the increasing water temperatures that could influence eelgrass. The upper bay, they don't care about temperature. Those plants like hot water. Chincoteague Bay Sanctuary, no scarring, and I think it's a good sign of the enforcement and the recognition by the watermen of the importance of this habitat. But there, as we saw, the changes in SAB, water quality is the major threat. Propeller scarring, again, low levels, and again, working with the watermen, it's been great because there's been no restrictions on what they do other than modifying the way they haul. But again, we feel by monitoring it, it allows us just to keep our pulse on what's happening and prevent anything from happening very quickly. The aquaculture issues are challenging and requiring compromises, and again, working with your staff, I think it's worked well. There haven't been a lot of issues that have come before you because we try to resolve those before it gets to your level. And the coastal bays, all I can say is this has been a project that I could have never dreamed of. You know, during the course of one's lifetime, most of us have seen the grass beds die back in front of our eyes. To see this change in this short a period of time is very encouraging, and the recognition that if we can improve water quality in the bay, these grass beds could come back to some of the areas that they were historically. And with some actions, I will need your support for the propeller scar monitoring and the bay scallop and eelgrass restoration work. We do get money from the Recreational Fishing Board, and we do put proposals into them. Right now, a lot of the funding for this is coming from NOAA. So the money that comes to us from the Recreational Board is in partial support. A lot of the support does come from NOAA, so we get a lot of federal support. So I've gone through a lot, but again, there's a huge crowd that has a lot of public hearings, and I don't want to take their time away from getting home and having dinner with their family. So if you have any questions, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Great presentation. Mr. Fox.
I've noticed in the Great Wicomico River, the water this winter has been incredibly clear. Mm-hmm. You can see the bottom in 5 to 7 feet.
That's true everywhere right now. Yes.
All right, is that a result of?
Well, wintertime, the water temperatures drop to where nothing grows.
Yeah.
And both the benthic animals, which rework the sediment, they're basically quiet for the winter, and there's nothing in the water column. This is just sometimes a very typical situation, but it changes, as you know, very quickly once the water temperature warms. It would be great to see this all year round. And, you know, you've been around the bay back in the 50s and 60s when there were grass beds everywhere. I came to the Virginia area in 1969, and there were grass beds everywhere, and they just disappeared very quickly. But again, you know, we've been hitting home, and this is a sentinel species. There's so many other things that are tied to water quality, but the grasses basically tell us a lot about the clarity of the water. So if we get the grass beds back, we know that water clarity is good.
Any other questions?
One quick question. In the bays, the coastal bays, are you seeing any increase in waterfowl use as a result of the eelgrass?
No, but what's really interesting, we've had people now fishing for speckled trout in these grass beds, and they're there. Now, that's kind of cool because in the lower bay, a lot of people target these grass beds for speckled trout. And this was a pretty impressive year for speckled trout. I don't know if you had heard, but boy, there were a lot of speckled trout, and they fish in a lot of these grass beds around the Mobjack. In the coastal bays, they have caught speckled trout before in certain areas around points of land, but now I think because there's so much grass, they're spreading out, and there are more speckled trout. As a matter of fact, one of the gentlemen that's on the Recreation License Board, we've been communicating, and he said, yeah, I went out and caught about 3 or 4 specks the other day in that grass bed. So as for waterfowl use, yeah, I think that's happening now. We just don't have people out in January and February, you know, watching those waterfowl. But I would bet they're out there.
Thank you. Do we have your proposal?
Yes, you do, sir. Yes.
We do?
It's there somewhere.
Yeah.
I gave it to Rob.
Do we have that in
there?
Okay.
We found the proposal.
No.
What happens when you do things electronically?
And
that's one thing we need. Like I said, the other part of it is coming through the Recreational Fishing Board, and they've been really supportive of our work. And again, you know, we couldn't do a lot of this without their support and some of the federal support that's been coming down the pipe.
You're looking for a continuation of funding to do your crop scoring study, $22,600.
$22,000, yes, sir.
And the staff recommendation is to approve this?
Staff recommendation is to approve. I will say that in talking to Jane McCroskey, it's going to be a close fit. And I think I also mentioned that to Dr. Orth when I mm-hmm. talked to him.
But you are recommending approval?
Yes.
All right. And we normally do that at this meeting.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Sir, Mr. Plumley?
I had one question also about the southern portion of the bay and the high salinity levels. I didn't think I heard what the explanation for
that. Okay, well, I do apologize for going fast because, again, I know that these guys want to get up here and talk, and I want to get out of here so that they can get their chance up here. The bay has a salinity of higher salinities in the lower bay to the upper bay. There are species that like salt. The saltier, the better. So as you get up into, like, Tangier Sound, up into Bloodsworth and South Marsh, the salinities decline and species change. But there is a species called eelgrasses, which is a species we're working in the coastal bays that likes salt and doesn't do well in very low salinities. So when I said the saltier, the better, of course, that's why it's doing very well in the coastal bays, because there the salinity is essentially full-strength seawater. As you move from the mouth of the bay, it gets to be less and less saltier as you get up into it, like the Tangier, where it gets to be about maybe 15 parts per thousand. So the idea was that, yeah, it's saltier, it's the high salinity species, and as you move up to the bay, you get different species because they don't like salt.
It wasn't doing well in the lower bay.
Well, right, because of the fact that it's a water quality issue and it's a big temperature issue right now. And eelgrass, which is the dominant species, actually it stops its growing in North Carolina. You don't find it south of North Carolina. It loves cold water, and it's found all the way up to Newfoundland on the east coast and to Alaska on the west coast. It just loves cold water. And so we're really concerned about, you know, the changes in temperature and the water temperatures in the bay that are influencing it now, as well as water quality.
Any other questions? Do you feel comfortable with a motion to approve the continuation of the funding?
Certainly do. Mm-hmm.
Who wants to move? I'll move to approve the proposal submitted.
Sorry.
Seconded by Mr. Fox. Any questions, comments on that? Any objection to continuing that funding? Seeing none, that funding is continued. Thank you again, Dr.
Thank you. And if you have any questions, you can always email me or call me anytime.
Appreciate it.
I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your work.